again and welcome to Musings on Golf. For today, you'll hear some powerful stories from Hal Sutton, the 1983 PGA champion and two-time winner of the Players' Championship. We'll also look back at an emotional win for Peter Malnati at the Valspar Championship. My name is Kelly Elbin, along with my good buddy Bob Bupka. Hey, Bob, your pal Hal Sutton, he doesn't pull any punches, does he?
No, he's a straight shooter. I've liked him for a long, long time. And I was just reflecting before we put him on Musings on Golf how things have changed just in the Ryder Cup. In 04, I was in the media covering the Ryder Cup at Oakland Hills in Detroit. Who stayed in that same hotel? The Ryder Cup team. I walked down to have breakfast one morning. There was Hal Sutton. We sat down, had a nice breakfast. Now, the Ryder Cup players are almost shielded like they're in Alcatraz when they show up at a golf event. So really has changed, and Hal's been one of the good guys. And you're going to get some keen insight when you're listening. To his performance on Musings on Golf. It was an honor to have him and thrilled to death. And speaking of thrilled to death, how about that winner at Valspar there, Mr. Kelly Elbin?
Yeah, if you can't get emotional and feel good about the Peter Malnati story, I'm not quite sure, at least when it comes to golf, who you can feel good about. Not almost 9 years since his last victory, and that was in the Sanderson's Farm Championship that didn't even qualify him in 2015 for the Masters. So by winning on Sunday, this will be his first trip to the Masters. He also qualifies for the PGA Championship. And not the longest hitter, but certainly among the most liked individuals on the PGA Tour. He's on the player director on the PGA Tour policy board, so he's dealt with a lot of slings and arrows from players, from media, and so forth. But Bob, obviously, when he focuses on his game, even though he's not the longest hitter, he hit the shots that mattered, and what a huge, cool win for a very deserving guy.
That moment of winning a tournament, having your family come out on the green, and the big hugs, that's something that I've seen other families have, and it's been my dream. You know, there's been a lot of stretches of golf in the last 9 years when wondered if I would ever have that experience. But man, was that special. That was so special. And it felt amazing. It was really validating for just all the hard work, all the times I've gotten on that plane and flown away from my family when they've stayed home. It was all preparing for that moment. And to get that second PGA Tour win, have it be here at the Valspar Championship, it's sinking in now, but it still feels completely surreal.
Absolutely incredible victory. And he's one of the good guys out there. And let's be honest, 9 years, you start wondering, you know, I did win once, but was that a fluke? And that's what a second victory does. It eliminates any stigma that his first win was a fluke. Because if you know, doing it once, maybe you got lucky, who knows? But when you do it a second time, it certainly makes a very bold statement about his ability to play this game.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I love doing this podcast with you, Bob. And we talk so much about sort of wrapping up guys who win, right? And the Scottie Schefflers of the world when we celebrate. There's a lot of dark times. Let's just be honest on the PGA Tour and how you deal with those dark times of not making cuts and not winning and having to go home early and seeing others celebrate. And what joy, right? The joy that comes from winning out there. I'm not sure you can top that as far as being a professional golfer on the PGA Tour.
Well, winning is one thing, Kelly, but winning when your family is alongside the 18th green and you got a little son that knows what's going on and he comes running to be in your arms, no greater feeling in the world. And congratulations. He's really a good guy, and I love seeing good guys win.
Hey, by the way, he plays with the yellow golf ball. He put that in play, he said, last summer at the 3M Open in Minnesota, and one of his kids liked the color golf ball, and he just decided to keep using it because it sort of reminds him of his kids, as you said, to have his family there with him. So that's the reason for the yellow golf ball. Something so simple can mean so much, right?
Yeah, good move on his part. I mean, really, it doesn't matter whether the golf ball's white or yellow. I mean, it's going to go in the hole the same way, whether it's white or yellow. No golf ball said, I'm not going in because I'm yellow.
A good move by the folks across the pond at TalkSport, re-upping with Mr. Bob Bubka for yet another year of golf analysis, golf updates. Just a little bit about that relationship that you have with them and what you'll be doing in calendar year 24, much like you've done many years before.
Yeah, this will be my 22nd year with TalkSport, the world's largest sports radio station. I'm their golf guy, proud to be their golf guy. I'll be covering all the majors for them and other big events and any other story that breaks in golf. If a story breaks in golf, and itself, our executive producer knows for sure the phone's going to be ringing, and it's going to be TalkSport. Want to get me on to get my opinion. I love the relationship. They're great people over there, and they're very, very professional, and it's a thrill. Hey, let me ask you something, Kelly.
Huh.
About our man, Red Evan, getting ready to climb Mount Everest. Any updates?
Yeah, I checked in with Rhett last week, and within the next few weeks, he heads to the climb of his life. He heads to Everest. He said it'll be about a two-month journey. We had Rhett on Musings on Golf, a month or so ago, and he was terrific. And talk about wishing someone well. I mean, that's a bucket list, Bob. I know that's not a bucket list item for you or for me, but for Rhett Evans, who is in obviously tremendous condition, and we wish him the very best. And he's promised to come back once he returns successfully from reaching the top, to come back and tell us the stories here on Musings on Golf. So wishing Rhett all the best, right?
Very fortunate, Kelly. Just stop and think. How many times in your life had you said to somebody, boy, I hope you get high. I hope you get high.
In this case, it's the best of highs that we want Rhett Evans to get to. Hey, one other thing before we throw it to the interview with Hal. I saw that the inaugural season of this TGL presented by SoFi, which is the tech-infused golf league that both Tiger and Rory are fronting, that will begin January 7th of 2025. It's going to be on primetime on ESPN and ESPN+. That was the one, Bob, that was supposed to start earlier this year here, not far from where I live, but the dome deflated on where they were supposed to play it, and they've rebuilt that in the process of rebuilding it much stronger. It'll be a three-man team event, virtual golf, played on Mondays with a lot of the well-known guys on the PGA Tour, sort of the next step. I know Hal Sutton won't be crazy about it because he's not exactly a tech guy, but a lot of people are, and anytime you've got Tiger and Rory fronting something, people will watch, I believe.
Yeah, and a little tip ahead of time of the Hal Sutton interview. People that are looking to improve their game, listen to Hal's words. Don't worry so much about being on the range. Get out there and play golf. Play golf. Play golf. Don't worry about all the technical aspects. You put that into play in your current game, I guarantee that handicap's going to come down.
Yeah, great points and great stuff coming up from Hal Sutton right after these messages. Just like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course. And that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William & Harry, and you should too. Folks, I love these golf shoes. They're made of deer skin and calf skin. They've got a soft gel insert, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance. And I got to tell you, they are so incredibly comfortable. So head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best, play your best with William & Harry.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Welcome back to Musings on Golf. Bob, our special guest today, won 14 times on the PGA Tour, including the 1983 PGA Championship and two Players' Championships. And it was in the latter of those two Players' titles that he proclaimed these five words, still resonate with golf fans nearly a quarter century later.
Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Oh, he was the right club, all right. He's the pride of Shreveport, Louisiana. Al Sutton, welcome to Musings on Golf. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Anyhow, Bob Bupka here, and this is not in the script, but I'm dying to ask it. How did you overcome being good-looking, wealthy, and talented in golf to carry it to the highest level like you did? I mean, those were obstacles. I mean, you were being compared to Jack Nicklaus.
Well, I don't know about good-looking and wealthy, but a lot of people had high hopes when I first went out there. And, you know, that was the biggest obstacle, was trying to live up to everybody else's expectations. You know, I played golf for me, and, you know, if I played well enough to make me happy, that was good enough. And then all of a sudden, when I had a lot of early success, everybody started, you know, heaping on the bear parent on me. And, you know, and then they would tell you that you were failing them, you know, and that's not why I played golf. You know, I played golf because I just loved the game. And anyways, that was a lot of pressure to live up to early on.
How did you feel that a lot, that pressure on an ongoing basis?
Yeah. I mean, every time a lot of people brought it up, you know, and you go in the media center, you know, after being rookie of the year and then player of the year after that, you know, you go in, I didn't win any the next year. I finished second like five or six times, but, you know, it wasn't good enough. And, you know, they'd say, what's wrong? How come? You know, and who has an answer for that, you know? Anyways, that was a lot of pressure to live up to early on.
How did you feel that a lot, that pressure on an ongoing basis?
Yeah, I mean, every time a lot of people brought it up, you know, you go in the media center, you know, after being rookie of the year and then player of the year after that, you know, you go in, I didn't win any the next year. I finished second like five or six times, but, you know, it wasn't good enough. And, you know, they'd say, what's wrong? How come? You know, and who has an answer for that, you know?
How did you get started in the game, Hal?
A good friend of my dad's gave my dad a set of clubs and said, you know, Hal's a good, I was playing all the other sports. And he said, Hal's a good athlete, but you need to get him started playing golf because he can play that for a lifetime. Well, that was the beginning of the end because I love golf so much that, you know, my focus went towards golf and a lot less towards the other sports. And, you know, I loved the game because if you did well, you got the credit. And if you did poorly, you got the blame. You know, I didn't have anybody else as an excuse.
Well, you certainly took full advantage of that early talent. Boy, oh, boy. I hate even bringing this up. I mean, there was a mistake in a magazine that had your demise a little bit premature. I guess you weren't too happy when you read about that.
Well, actually, I didn't read it. First telephone call I got was from Bert Bain that he had seen Trevino, and Trevino said, man, did you read about Hal passing away? And Bert said, he hadn't passed away. I just talked to him. And so then Trevino calls me on the phone and said, man, I just read about this. And, you know, then the call started coming in because a lot of people read about it. And, you know, that's kind of a weird thing. I hope y'all don't have to read that sort of thing about yourself. It's better that we don't read that. It's better that we're already gone.
You're taking it very well, my friend. Taking it very well. Go ahead, Kel.
But I was wondering how, you know, we've cleared that up. What's going on in your life today before we start to walk down memory lane a little bit? What's up?
Well, I had done the academy here in Houston, and a good friend of mine called me and asked me if I'd help him build a golf course out here. And I came out and met with him, and he talked about everything being a tribute to history. And I fell in love with the idea. So we did a C.B. McDonald and Seth Rayner Golden Age golf course on a piece of property that was mined for sand and gravel 130 years ago. So it's a special piece of property. And then he hired an architectural firm here in Houston, Curtis and Windham, to draw the buildings, and the buildings are a tribute to history as well. William Wersner is an architect from California, turn-of-the-century architect that actually built, designed Alistair McKenzie's house at Pasta Tiempo and Marion Holland's house at Pasta Tiempo, who she did Cypress Point and Pasta Tiempo. So, I mean, everything we've done is like over-the-top, first-class tribute to history. And of course, that was right up my alley, because I think golf has gone a completely wrong direction. I think we're too data driven. We're too golf swing. We're not enough golf. And so I spent the last year and a half, I moved out here and I spent the last year and a half developing this place. And Todd, the guy that has built all this, said, hey, this needs to be your final chapters here. You need to run this place to the very end, to be the gatekeeper, to make sure that we live this, what we're building here. And it's been, I've actually had more fun than I've ever had in my life. I would stack this up on top of any tournament win I ever had, just because I feel like this is a creation that will live on forever, because it is over the top. So,
hey, Hal, what's the name of it, number one? And then number two, as golf course architecture, designing golf courses, has that always been something that you've wanted to do, or did it, was it sort of at the latter part of your career that you got interested in it?
Well, the name of it is called Darmor Club, and D-A-R-M-O-R. And golf course architecture is not something that I necessarily always wanted to do. I did boot ranch, 20 years ago, and it's turned out to be fabulous. And when this piece of property became available, I mean, he had it and he showed it to me. It just, there was a golf course out there and it was meant to be, and it was easy to do this. And so I wanted something to do. My dad's 91 years old. He still goes to the office every day, and I'm not a quitter, and I'll work till the day I die, basically. And I needed something to hang my hat on and that I knew about. You know, golf is what I know. And entertaining is what I've done for a long time. So this fits right into what Hal Sutton should be doing.
Hey, Hal, you mentioned the name Seth Rayner. Are you aware that the golf course right next door to Shinnecock is a place called Southam Golf Club, which I was a member of, and club champ, by the way, designed by Seth Rayner?
I was aware of that. And, I mean, he and C.B. McDonald, I don't know how many people know this, but C.B. McDonald, they developed these templates and, of great holes and fun designs, and brought them over here. And I've used several of their templates in order to build this. And, I just love golden age architecture, but you got to have the right piece of property to do it. And Cypress Point's my very favorite golf course in the world. So if God came down and said, Al, you got 24 hours, so what do you want to do? I'm going to say, I want the first tee time at Pebble Beach. And as soon as I finish, I'm going to go over and finish on Cypress Point. And, I love it because it goes into the Monterey Forest and it comes out and goes into the sand dunes. Then it goes back into the Monterey Forest and then it goes out by the Pacific Ocean. So as a golfer, there's always a new interest level going on, and it's not, same thing, same boring thing. And I used that same thing in what I did. Went into the mined area, then I went down by the river, then I went back into the mined area, then I went around the mined area. So kind of all the philosophies of the place that I love, I tried to implement.
Did you ever play National Golf Links of America?
I've been out there, but I've never played it. But that's, you know, one of the most famous ones of all.
Yeah, it sure is. And, you know, next door to Shinnecock, that's it. Ben Crenshaw told me, I think about 30 years ago, how he was doing a thing for a magazine, and the best 18 holes in the Met area, and one was on Shinnecock, and one was going to be on National, and I had been friends with him because of Harvey Pienick. So I'm giving him a ride over to National, and he said, Bob, I'm going to tell you, National and Shinnecock are the two finest golf courses on the planet that touch one another.
That's probably right, too.
And to this day, I've never heard of two finer, but boy, oh boy, I'm excited about this new project you're underway with. It sounds like it's going to be not special, but I think extra special.
Well, it will be. It's, you know, if you don't know a lot about golf, you can't work at Darmore Club. You know, the truth is, I'm trying to put everybody in place that really understands the game at a very deep level. And, you know, we live in a world where everybody needs to be coddled all the time, and I can't stand that. You know, that's not where I learned how to play golf. And one of the other things that's really wrong with golf is we've got kids today that think they can learn the game in a room. And, you know, everything is data-driven, and, you know, I'm tired of all of that. You know, one of the things that I like the most about Scottie Scheffler is that he doesn't practice that. He plays golf. He doesn't play golf swing. He plays golf. And, you know, I learned how to play golf on the golf course, not in a room. And, you know, not on a driving range either, by the way. I spent 45 holes a day on the golf course. So my whole goal with this place is that we built an incredible practice facility, but you'll be able to go out and practice on the golf course. And that's where you really learn to love the game.
1983 PGA champion Hal Sutton joining us here on Musings on Golf. Hal, I mentioned earlier about you being from Shreveport. You went on and played your All-American at Centenary in Shreveport. Did you ever consider going outside of the area? Were you kind of a homebody at that time? Why did you stay local as far as playing collegiately?
That's a great question. It narrowed down between Houston and Centenary. And my dad talked me into going to Centenary because he could keep a watchful eye on me, I'm sure. But, you know, I vowed that one day I would move to Houston, and 10 years ago I did move to Houston. He was in the oil business, so we'd have been a lot better off if I'd have moved down here and gotten to know a bunch of people in the oil business. But so be it. We didn't do that, and I stayed at home and went to Centenary, and just because I wanted him to be happy, you know. I mean, I spent too much of my life trying to please everybody else instead of Hal Sutton. I'm not sure I made the decision for Hal. All the decisions that I made early on in my life were based on other people's feelings. And, you know, if I had any advice out there to anybody, I would say seek a deep understanding of your own feelings first and then others after that.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I think I can relate to some of that. I think a lot of people can relate to it. Hey, I mentioned earlier about 14 times you won on the PGA Tour, the three big ones. But the first one had to be special. 82 Walt Disney World Classic. You beat Bill Britton in sudden death. What do you recall from that first win on tour?
Well, quite a bit. But, I mean, the main thing I remember is I was in the last group the last day. I think I shot 67, but I made about a 15 to 20 foot left to right breaker in order to get in the playoff. And Bill had finished earlier, shot real low that day. And I think he shot 64 the last round or something. And, you know, I the week before we were in Pensacola, and Calvin Pete beat me by one or something like that. I was just, you know, I was climbing the ladder, just hadn't quite got there. And I had this left to right breaker. I never will forget it. And I told Freddie, I said, you know, I'm going to make this putt. I know I can make this putt. And I mean, I drilled it right in the middle of the hole. And then I had to make about an eight footer or so on the fourth playoff hole to win.
Psychologically, what's that like to win. And part of the reason I asked, Cameron Young finished runner-up at Valspar. It's his seventh runner-up on the tour, Hal. He hasn't won yet. Psychologically, what was it like for you to win as opposed to being so close to winning?
Well, I mean, it's a big boost in your confidence. I mean, in my case, it was the last tournament of the year. So, you know, I wished it had come earlier where I could have kept playing and used some of that confidence as, I mean, I was able to parlay it into the next year. But anyway, you know, I said earlier when we were visiting that winning runs into you. You don't run into winning. The harder you try sometimes, the harder it becomes. And sometimes you just have to, and I mean, my advice to Cameron Young is just keep doing the things right. And when it's your time, you're going to win. Don't answer. I mean, everybody, like you just said, he's runner up seven times. You're not the only person that has told him that. And trust me, he's dealing with that all the time. You know, that's what I told you that I kind of didn't like early on in my career. It's like, well, he's having to answer, why haven't you won? All the talent that you've got, why haven't you won? He's asking himself that same question. And so, you know, my advice to Cameron Young is just keep doing what you're doing. It's obviously really good. Your time will appear, and it may repeat itself over and over again when it does.
And so 82, that was the win at Disney was the final in 82, and then 83 was the year of Hal Sutton. I mean, you won the Players' Championship. You held off Jack to win by a shot at Riviera for the PGA Championship, money winner, player of the year. What a stretch of golf. What was so dramatically different? What was on for you in all ways in 83?
Well, you know, maybe the biggest one that I didn't win was at Oakmont that year. I had like 23 or 4 birdies and finished fourth or fifth in the tournament. Should have won it, could have won it. Larry Nelson won it, but I could have won it too. And had to lead after 45 holes and was Watson and Sammy Ballesteros and I playing in the final group. So, you know, I was a much more aggressive player then. As I began to understand what golf was about, I became maybe too calculated because I didn't take chances sometimes when a successful chance might have been what I needed to parlay it into a win. I started trying to play and make money so that I would continue to be able to have a job on the tour. So as I look back, I didn't see this at the time. I was living it every day. But as I look back, I became not enough focused on winning, and I was more focused on making sure I had a job forever. So I would caution people against that.
And yet you did all the right things. I mean, talk a little bit, please. I was out at Riviera in 83 and watched you hold off Jack. What was it? Just a kid still at that point, and you've got the greatest player in the world right on your heels. What was that like?
Well, to recap a little bit, I had lost a 6-shot lead at Anheuser-Busch 2 weeks before, and it was not Calvin Peet ended up winning the tournament, but it wasn't what he did so good; it's what I did so bad.
Yeah.
So, and then I took off the next week and had to live with an embarrassing 6-shot lead. I mean, I thought you could spot me 6 shots and nobody in the world could beat me. I might beat 2 guys best ball if I had a 6-shot lead, and I couldn't even beat Calvin at that time. So I was embarrassed, to say the least. And, you know, I came home, went to work on the things that I knew I needed to work on, went out there. I knew I was ready. Paired with Lanny Watkins and Lee Trevino the first round, I shoot 65, 66 back-to-back. And I'm rolling along really good. And then the last day, I had a 4-shot lead going into 12, and I bogeyed 12, 13, and 14. And I thought, man, I'm going to have to relive this again. I never will forget it. On 15T, I told Freddie, give me that towel. And I just stuck my head into the towel. And I said, we cannot do this again because this will define us. So all I know to do from this point forward is to hit the drive in the fairway on 15. That's all I can do right now. And what happens when you get caught up in those moments, you start trying to do everything. And I basically singled it down to just 1 shot at a time. I tell everybody to do that all the time, but I had to do it right there. You know, I couldn't couldn't concentrate on the second shot in the 15th because I needed that drive at the fairway. And I did a good job of it, you know, and I was able to get it in. Jack was playing ahead of me, and I knew he was burning it up. We didn't have the electronic scoreboards at the time, you know, but I could tell by the crowd that he was burning it up. So, you know, it was fun. He was my idol. So to be able to hold him off, you know, that was great.
Well, it's really a privilege and an honor to have Hal Sutton with us on Music Zone Golf. Matter of fact, I'm going to discard the final question I was supposed to ask you, and that is, what would you do different at the Ryder Cup? Everybody knows what happened there. We don't have to go over that and just leave it at that. But really has been a privilege, Hal Sutton. You're one of the real good guys. Forget your talent on the golf course. You're one of the real good guys off the golf course, and that's what golf really needs. Unfortunately, right now, it seems to be in the direction of money, 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 and it leaves a sour taste in my mouth. Somebody that's followed this sport and covered this sport and loved this sport, all this talk about money is not good for the game, in my eyes, Hal.
Well, Bob, it's not good in my eyes either. I thought legacy meant something, you know, but the almighty dollar is what the world is going after right now. And that's one of the things I love most about what I'm doing right now is I'm doing this for the love of the game. I'm doing this because this is the game that I love. I'm not trying to make a whole lot of money off of this. I'm trying to leave something in the game that means I understood the game. And, you know, I don't like where LIV has gone, taken this. I don't like where the tour has responded and gone to this. I don't know what the right thing is. I'm not going to tell you that I got the answer to this. You know, I'm going to tell you that I felt like I got paid really well for doing this. And apparently these guys were making way more money before LIV came along than I ever dreamed about making. But that wasn't enough. And, you know, what is enough? Where do we stop in this world? You know, I will add this. You know, Greg Norman, I played a lot of golf with Greg Norman. And he's had a burr in his saddle against the tour for a long, long time. And I will tell you that you wouldn't even know who Greg Norman was if it wasn't for the PGA Tour. And how do you bite the hand off this Fedgie for so long? Why do that? And I'm just amazed at what's going on, you know.
So, Hal, let's drill down a little bit to the tour's premier event and 2000 and beating Tiger. So, really, when you look back at your career in so many ways, you were a giant killer, beating Jack in 83, Tiger in 2000. Talk a little bit, please, about the intensity, the drama on those final few holes at TPC Sawgrass and what led to just a classic six-iron shot on the final hole.
You mentioned beating both of them. I don't know that. Again, I say winning runs into you. You know, I just happened to be the guy in the time that could do that. I felt more pressure to beat Tiger than I ever felt to beat Jack, because at the time nobody was beating Tiger, and we, admittedly, there were many professionals that actually said to the media that we're playing for second, Colin Montgomery being one of them. And, you know, Davis Love got beat at Bay Hill the week before where he had a 3-shot lead and Tiger beat him, you know. And, I mean, I just remember thinking, you know, this is a golf course that I know I can beat him, because Pete Dye builds golf courses that are point A to point B to point C, and not how long can you hit it. And I knew at the time I was playing as good as anybody from point A to point B to point C. And so, I mean, I just took the task. I took it on that, okay, this is my week and I'm going to do it. And I was able to do it. You know, I ended up having a 3-shot lead going into 16. We got rained out on Sunday and I had told my caddy, we got to get to 16 with a 3-shot lead. if we can get to 16 with a three-shot lead, that means I play, I can make par, he can make eagle, and then we're going to 17 and 18 with a one-shot lead. He's got to play both those holes the same way I got to play. So I'll play him heads up with a one-shot lead. And that's exactly what happened. And the reason why I put that in my head is I didn't want to be surprised by that. You know, if I hadn't planned on that and then that happened like it did, it actually happened just like that. Then, you know, the walk from 16 green to 17 tee and the crowd going crazy could be unnerving. And I had already planned on that happening. So I wasn't unnerved by that. And anyway, you know, it was a dream come true. That was his greatest year ever on tour, was 2000. And, you know, he played great. And I would just happen to be the one guy that stood up and got in his way that one time.
Would you care to rank your three wins, the 83 PGA and the two players championships, in terms of which was the greatest to you? What was beating, because of that situation, was it Tiger? Was that the biggest one?
Yeah, I think probably beating Tiger at the time. Not so much beating Jack at Riviera, doesn't get any better than that. The greatest player in the world and one of the greatest golf courses in the world. But, you know, just the very time in golf that Tiger Woods ends up being the guy that makes you wonder if Jack was the best in the world. You know, that's the two that they talk about. You know, Tiger was having his way with everybody at that time. And I'd have to say that was a timely win.
All right, Kelly, find out from him who you'd like to play with.
Okay, Al, so we always ask this of our guests, if to complete a dream foursome, whether those three individuals are living or deceased, who would be your dream foursome, your three other players, and where would you play that one round? Sounds like Cypress Point might be up there, huh?
Cypress Point would be where we'd play. And I think I'd play with Byron Nelson, Jackie Burke, and Jack Nicklaus. That would be my dream force.
Not too shabby now.
Well, Jackie was like a second father to me. And he was a great player. And one of the things that I always loved about Jackie, and I'll miss this, is he was a truth sayer. You know, he thought the truth was more important than your feelings. And he felt like there was growth in the truth. And most people try to avoid that. Jackie was really good at not avoiding. And, of course, I worked with Byron Nelson for a while, and I don't think I ever was around a finer gentleman than Byron Nelson. And then, of course, you know, I idolized Jack. Everything he did, I watched and tried to emulate, you know. So that's my dream foursome.
Pretty good as far as I'm concerned. Just nudging out God, I think. He probably he'd be next. Al, I'm going to let Kelly say goodbye because I'd talk to you for the next 8 hours. By the way, you say in Houston. I'm in Houston. How far away am I from you?
Well, Columbus, I don't know where you are in Houston. We could be an hour and a half away if we lived on the opposite side of town.
Yeah.
Oh, so if I came out there, we could have lunch maybe?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'd love to do that.
Yes, sir.
I'll save up and then I'll drive out.
Okay.
All right. Hey, Al, a final question for me, and it has to do with what you and Kelly Gibson and David Toms, your fellow Louisianans, did when you had the hurricanes, both Katrina and Rita, unfortunately, affect so many lives in your home state. You guys raised a lot of money back then. What did you all do, and why did you feel compelled to take the lead and do whatever you could to help out?
Well, because everybody was so devastated by Katrina, for one thing, you know, and then we did various things. David and I both, and then Kelly in South Louisiana. David and I were North Louisiana, and Kelly was South Louisiana, and we did a number of things to try to help our state. You know, along with the Katrina, we helped build a children's hospital in Shreveport there for a while. And, you know, Louisiana's got a lot of passionate people in it. And when you are passionate about what you're doing there, they have a giving heart. And everybody showed it with all of the giving for Katrina and the Children's Hospital and everything else. So, you know, I think David and Kelly and I were all excited to be part of those fundraisers for helping our community.
Please say goodbye to your good friend. And Hal, from my standpoint, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a real treat.
Yeah, once again, Hal, thanks for joining us on Musings on Golf. You're a special person. You've been a special guest. Thanks, Hal.
Thanks, Bob. Thank y'all.
Just like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course. And that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoe from William & Harry. I love these golf shoes. They're made of deerskin and suede with a soft gel insert and reinforced hardened soft spikes that increase stability and balance, and they are so incredibly comfortable. I invite you to head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best and play your best with William & Harry.
You've heard us talking for several months about a fantastic golf shoe that is now available to you, the William & Harry golf shoe. I proudly say it'll make you look better, it'll make you play better, it'll make you feel better. William & Harry, actually the leading edge right now in golf shoes, not only for function, but for style. Next opportunity you have, put on a pair of William & Harry golf shoes.
Yeah, and when you visit williamandharry.com, select your shoes and be sure to put in the code KECHARITY and the number 10. That's KECHARITY10. But Bob, it was really interesting to hear Hal talk about winning, sort of running into you, and just like he was saying about Cameron Young, seven times a runner-up. Just keep playing. Just keep playing the game well, and good things will happen.
Yeah, good advice. And obviously, Cameron Young, I've got all the talent in the world, came out Rookie of the Year, now seven-time runner-up on the PGA Tour. He's going to win, but he's certainly getting tired of people asking him when he's going to win.
No question. Well, we thank Hal Sutton very, very much. Next week, the great amateur Stuart Hagestad, who won the U.S. Mid-Amateur Championship last year that qualified him for yet another Masters, will be joining us on Musings on Golf. For my good buddy, Bob Bupka, Kelly Elpin, signing off once again, Musings on Golf.